This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Scott Tungay. Scott, it's great meeting you.
Yeah, thank you. Likewise.
So obviously the big thing in the news is all these riots going on across the nation. When this show is posted, there's obviously going to be new updates, and this will be a little dated. All the different major American cities, Minneapolis, Atlanta, Houston, Oakland, California. So we'll definitely get to this in the show, but just start things off. Scott, can you give us some personal background about yourself? You're originally from Natal, South Africa.
Yeah. So I grew up in South Africa. I'm a eighth generation on my mom's side, probably a fourth generation Anglo.
You trace most of all your family to England?
Yeah, so mostly English ancestry, and then a little bit of Dutch German as well, you know, in there. But I was raised in the English culture. So South Africa has about 2 million English South Africans and about 2 to 3 million Afrikaans or Boer South Africans. You know, so that's the two white groups in South Africa, and so I would identify as English South African. So yeah, I grew up in South Africa, and I met an American girl who was out here on a mission trip, and we got married, and obviously over that side in America, and settled in Kentucky. So I've been living in Kentucky for 4 years, and then we obviously try to visit my family every winter, and this winter we got stuck with all of the coronavirus chaos. So I'm currently in sunny South Africa, been here for the last 4 or 5 months now, but obviously we'll make my way back across to America once things open back up. Yeah, and then just as far as background, I never went to college, which is shaping up to be a good thing in light of indoctrination and and all of that. I tried to become a professional rugby player out of high school. And, you know, the dream ended up dying. But I've, ever since, you know, coaching is the career I'm trying to get into as far as coaching rugby is concerned. And then also have a real passion for, homesteading. My wife and I really, we love, permaculture and the agrarian lifestyle. So that's something we're trying to, set up together. And then as far as, you know, business is concerned, my family, I've worked with my family. We have a holiday resort, kind of the best way for Americans to understand it would be, you know, a bunch of mountain cabins up in the mountains in South Africa. And so that's the business I grew up in. And I obviously have a few investments there still. And I would consider property and real estate a passion of mine as far as wealth building is concerned. So that's kind of a bit of my background. And then politically, you know, I was raised an English liberal, a classical liberal, ventured into libertarianism. But I feel like that was a defense. You know, when you live in a multicultural society like South Africa, where you are the minority, libertarianism becomes a defense from having to be ostracized and attacked. You just kind of say, hey, well, look, I'm going to go off into the woods. You leave me alone. But when I came across to America, I was like, wow, this place is amazing. You know, for the first time, I felt like I was around my own people, being in a majority white, majority Christian, nation. Well, you know, I was in South Carolina for a bit. I was in Kentucky, and my in-laws live in Ohio. So the America that I've experienced is agrarian. It's, you know, mostly post-Christian, but nonetheless a Christian culture. And so for the first time in my life, I was like, oh my gosh, like this is worth fighting for. This is amazing. And I think a nationalist spark was lit in my heart of it's not okay to just run off into the woods and kind of hope that they eat me last. You know, there's this kind of desire for belonging to a people and belonging to a place. I started reading Wendell Berry, and he's a famous Kentucky author, mostly on agrarianism and localism. And that shaped a lot of my current ideas that I hold. So that's kind of philosophically as well where my background.
So Scott, when you were growing up, did most of the people you associate with were from an Anglo background? Like, how divided were things? Because that's a sort of general perception about South Africa. Did you have friends of different backgrounds, acquaintances, and what were the kind of general demographics of where you grew up? Is this Natal? That's the Zulu region.
Yes. Yeah. So I was born in 1990, which was right on the cusp of the handover. So apartheid handed over. There was a negotiation period from 1990 right up until 1994. And 1994, the black nationalist ANC government took over power. So I grew up completely integrated. My schools were about 50-50 black and white. My sports teams, my churches, my social circles, we were very much integrated. I grew up in a rural area, farming community, and obviously the economic class I'm in is very white. So I would call myself upper middle class in South Africa, and obviously, you know, that remains pretty white in my area. Obviously all of our staff, majority black. And as far as you know, the whole multicultural rainbow nation, I was fully in on that. You know, I grew up. Our education obviously was huge. The whole diversity is our greatest strength. The whole rainbow nation, to a point where I almost gave up my British. I would say that the South African Anglo has very little in-group preference. They're very liberal as compared to the American population. I would put them, you know, right up there with the Democratic, with the Democrat kind of ideology of race.
I mean, a lot of people who are kind of right-wing would assume that they'd be more conservative considering the situation, but you'd actually say that the Americans you've met in Kentucky are much more conservative than the South African Anglos.
Yes, yeah, I would consider the and I'm making broad generalizations here. Obviously, I myself have grown far more conservative the older I get, and the more of the world I experience. There are a lot of agrarian Anglos here who would be quite conservative, but I would make the parallel that, you know, your rural Kentucky, rural Carolina, kind of the two. And Ohio, rural Ohio, I suppose, the groups that I've had extensive interaction with in America are basically just English-speaking Afrikaners. So the Afrikaners are a very agrarian nation. They're very conservative. They obviously have a huge liberal urban population, like any culture would. But on the whole, Afrikaners have a much bigger in-group preference, and they still hold to more traditional Christian values. And so the parallel I give people is that the South, of the American South, the Dixie culture is very similar to how Afrikaners are. And the North, the individualistic urban liberal culture, is very similar to the African Anglos.
South Africa has one of the most draconian lockdowns in the world. Can you talk about that situation? When you first arrived, like, when did you find out, and how the impacts of the lockdown, also like the economic impacts as well?
Yeah, so we arrived I quit my job in the States, and we had saved up some money. So my wife's visa in South Africa lasts 3 months. So, you know, it costs a bit of money to come out here. So let's go for the full 3 months. So we were due to return middle of April, and the lockdown started right at the beginning of April. So, you know, we didn't think it would be anything great. So we were like, you know, we'll be able to catch our flight. Don't worry about rescheduling it sooner or whatever. And sure enough, yep, things got super draconian. The airlines were all canceled. From what I hear, there's about 60,000 American nationals in the country. So there have been expatriation flights and all that, but super expensive and always super last minute, so it's hard to plan for them. So my wife and I have just decided to ride it out. It's a lot cheaper to live here on our savings than it is to you know, come back across to America and get back into the economy and all that. But yeah, so the lockdown regulations here, we have, a lot of people don't understand about South Africa, is that we actually have a communist ruling party. They would consider themselves very Leninist. Now, the Leninists believe in class warfare, as they want a society of two classes, the poor and then the political elite who looks after them. And so they are loving this lockdown because it's giving them an opportunity to really put draconian control measures on the middle class business populace, which is, I would say, you know, 60 to 70% white at this point. And what that allows them to do, they've been talking for a while now, at least 10 years, the ANC government, of something called expropriation without compensation, which is basically the Zimbabwean plan of just taking the farmer's land. You know, hey, we're going to take it, we're not going to compensate you, and we're going to redistribute this land to the black poor class. Now, obviously, that would make them look bad in the eyes of the international community. So this lockdown is a perfect opportunity to basically starve the businesses into bankruptcy, which would then let the banks reap the middle class's assets, land, you know, etc. And then basically this is my opinion, the government can then bail out the banks by buying up those middle class assets. So we're almost on about 60 days now where businesses, only the essential businesses, have been open. So my family, obviously, we are in the hospitality industry, so our businesses have been closed, not allowed to operate for almost 2 months now. And because we're white, we cannot apply for state aid, if you want to call it that. It's only going out to black majority businesses. So they're essentially starving a lot of the white businesses in the economy. And it's of my opinion that they want to actually, you know, enforce mass bankruptcy and buy up those assets.
There could very well be a major economic collapse, and I mean, globally, there could be an economic collapse, but yes, specifically in South Africa, as you were on this show, Willem Petzer is a South African YouTuber, and you were talking about making comparisons to Yugoslavia and the conflict that happened there about 25 years ago. And you described different scenarios. So one scenario is a sort of a breakup, and you have these different secessionist movements, civic nationalism in the Cape Republic movement, and then the Zulu separatists. So what are the different scenarios that you could see?
Yeah, you know, it's there's about 11 sovereign cultures. I use the word sovereign as in cultures that would be able to stand alone should the Empire of South Africa fall. So South Africa as an empire was mandated by the British in 1910. They basically just threw all these cultures together in an arbitrary, you know, lines around the map. And so today what we have is 11 different nations fighting for the one ring to rule them all. And right now it's a Pan-Africanist, black nationalist, Leninist government that's in charge. But what they don't, what they've kind of masked over right now, because the whites are the enemy, the big enemy to rally everyone behind. But there was huge tribal infighting in the 80s and 90s about which black group would take power once apartheid fell. So the Zulus were fighting the Xhosas. Those are the two biggest ethnic black groups, the Zulus and the Xhosas. Now, the Zulus have a royal family, and that royal family owns about 30% of the land in the province I live in, KwaZulu-Natal. But they are paid by the government. The king gets a stipend from the tax budget every year. So he's basically paid, his loyalty is paid off. And there's about, I don't know, another eight tribal chieftains around the country who have a similar deal. They own huge tracts of land, and they are paid by the government essentially for their loyalty. Now the Cape it's pretty much the most European culture of all the different provinces. They have, you know, Cape Town is just a stunning city. And their provincial government is the only of the nine provinces, or, you know, so in America it would be equivalent of a state. Their state, their province is the only one that has a non ANC government running it. So they have an opposition party in power there. And, you know, they have a very liberal white population there. So they should they ever secede, it would never be along racial lines. It would be the reasons given would be economic and political, and, you know, with fear of offense, they wouldn't want to be lumped in with the apartheid propaganda and history, because that's what any, you know, if they did secede, the ANC government would just be like, oh, these guys are racist and we are the liberation organization, and they would project power back into that province to win it back over. So secession is not a very realistic plan at the moment. You know, I think we're all just waiting for the empire to crumble and see what comes of it.
So yeah, there could very well be some kind of economic collapse. What do you see as worst case scenarios that could happen as a result?
Yeah, our government is severely indebted to the Chinese. They've struck up quite a big economic partnership. So the Chinese have been basically propping up our government with loaned money. So what I foresee happening is, you know, should the ANC crumble and there's infighting, and, you know, these secessionist movements take an opportunistic shot, and let's say all hell breaks loose, the worst case scenario I foresee happening is the Chinese intervening, you know, sending a military force and actually intervening to secure their mineral rights that they have as a security against their loans, and basically just instituting colonialism version 2, China style.
Do you think there could be a, like, worst case scenario would be something similar to what happened in Rwanda? Is that, do you see that as possible?
Africa already is a bloodbath. We have about 50 murders on average per day in the country. Most of that is black on black violence. The problem with Rwanda was there were just two tribes fighting over one geographical area. We have, you know, 11 big tribes, including the two white tribes, fighting over a geographical area. And that geographical area was quite a lot larger than Rwanda. So, you know, if fighting were to break out, I don't think it would be genocidal. I think it would be boundary setting fights, you know. So how far can we push our boundaries at as little cost as possible? If there were to be fighting, I would see it happening that way, not necessarily genocidally.
Are most whites looking to escape the country to go somewhere like Europe or Australia?
Yes, yeah. So, like I said on Willem's show, the reason Zimbabwe failed so quickly, the reason their ship sank, their economy tanked so quickly, was because there was a civilized country for that white middle class to run to. So basically, Zimbabwe started implementing Leninist policies in the 80s and 90s. And basically the white population just picked up, packed all their stuff, and came straight across the border to South Africa. The problem with South Africa is we have a captive middle class. So there is no other country surrounding us to run to that is civilized and willing to accept white people and not create, you know, racial strife against them. So I think there's been, on average, I could be wrong on this, but I think there's been on average about 100,000 middle-class people leaving the country every year since the late 90s. So South Africa is hemorrhaging the white middle class at about 100,000 a year, and there's about 4 million left. And I think after this, you know, let's say, you know, a third to maybe half of the middle class gets bankrupted because of this lockdown. I can't foresee anyone being stupid enough to stay and try and restart their business, restart their life in such an uncertain economy. So Australia is a huge draw. England is a huge draw. Obviously, America is a huge draw. The only problem is all of these Anglosphere countries have anti-white immigration policies.
The UK is talking about granting a massive refugee status to the people of Hong Kong.
Oh, really? That's quite amazing. Yeah, I don't see them doing that for South African whites. You know, England has a long history of throwing African Anglos under the bus. You know, they basically consider all Rhodesians as evil racists, and I wouldn't be surprised if they considered South Africans as evil racists. And so I think there would be a huge push by, you know, African or South African legal bodies to declare us as a refugee status. But I don't think that liberals in England would accept that.
Yeah, I don't even think that, like, the Tories would either, or even, like, U.S. Republicans. I don't even think Trump would.
No. I mean, he's sent a tweet here and there of, like, oh, we're monitoring the situation in South Africa. But you see, the problem comes in with political propaganda of, you don't want to be the party or the president who sided with the racist, evil Nazi whites of South Africa. You know, that's what it really comes down to when the propaganda machine starts up.
As far as what's going on now in American cities, what are your thoughts on that and these ongoing riots, and what do you expect as the outcome? We've had riots like this before, about the Ferguson riots, which were nothing comparable to this, and obviously the LA riots.
Yeah.
It's just this, like, perfect storm with all these things going together. So we have the virus, the pandemic, the riots going on, and then there's the mass layoffs and the economic issues.
Yeah, I think a huge baseline worldview that we've got to hold as our number one discernment tool is whatever the mainstream media is saying has an agenda. You know, I think the days of trusting just your local newscast or just switching on CNN and being like, oh, okay, well, that's probably true, I think those days are long gone. And so anything that the media pushes, anything that the mainstream, and a lot of people would be like, oh, so you trust Fox News? And it's like, no. All of it is bad. All of it is owned by the same kind of agenda of how do we, there's a cultural agenda in America that's very obvious. I have a feeling that America is 20 to 30 years away from where South Africa is. This multicultural division, like divide and conquer. You know, so in my, you know, I made a tongue-in-cheek tweet a while back, but a guy said, name the three branches of government, wrong answers only. And so my three wrong answers were banks, academia, media. And in America, the banks, academia, and media, they are the shapers of consensus and pop culture. And in a democracy, that's all that matters. That's the main tools of warfare.
The current system is a lot of political types will talk about, like, tyranny. But the current system, if you want to describe it as, like, neoliberalism, its power, its legitimacy is still, at this point, it's still based on soft power.
Exactly. And so that soft power is now manifesting in what we're seeing here of a hard lockdown and hard riots. So the lockdown was totally a media hit job, you know. So right from the beginning, when back in December, January, when, you know, at then it was just the laughing at memes of people eating bat soup and the Wu flu and the, you know, we were just laughing at it at that stage. Come February, March, it's like, oh my gosh, like, they're going to use this. This is an election year. China are in a trade war with Trump that is literally, China are, they are at they were at the precipice of does their economic gamble pay off and they become the world global industrial superpower, or does Trump cripple them and they fail in their debt and their they themselves are a house of cards, their society, and their gamble has paid off. You know, that it looks like right now they're winning the war against Trump. And then the Democrats and the news media and the banks and the academia, that whole triumvirate, are just jumping on board like, oh yeah, this plays into us, like we also hate Trump, let's go hard at this. And so, you know, all this fear-mongering and scare tactics of the coronavirus, like it was a perfect storm of the soft power having a way to have a hard lockdown and to really go hard and hurt the American heartland and the American economy and all of that. Then when it comes to the race riots, you know, the interesting just statistically, if you want to take it unemotionally, you know, I've got no issue with different cultures. I've got no issue with different races. I respect every race and I expect respect back. I expect reciprocity. Now, when it comes to America, the statistics are that there is 8 times more black on white violence than there is white on black violence. Now, what I do with that statistic, my analysis on that, is that all of humanity is depraved. We have a sin issue. But here comes the problem, Robert, is that American liberals, and I would throw in the American church, which is a very liberal institution, they treat every white person as a Christian. They hold every white person in America to Christian morality standards. And they hold and treat every black person in America as a victim. Now, how this plays out is that every white person is now an oppressor and evil, no matter how good they are. And every black person is a victim and is good, no matter how bad or how badly they act. And so what we've seen in the last month or so, starting with that whole Arbery media story, is a huge switch of the media narrative from lockdown, 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 lockdown to black victim, black victim, black victim, black victim, white people evil, white people evil. And so it's like, okay, this is very interesting. You know, so I expect there to be one more, you know, huge, big black on white, white on black story coming out with the news.
The thing is I don't know how sustainable it is, the narrative, because these in the past, like these riots were smaller scale and they were contained after a while. If this gets like really out of control, and there are like, there's footage of them going into like nicer, more middle class or upper middle class suburban areas. So yeah, I mean, it could really change the narrative if this gets really out of control.
Yeah. And so here's my take on it, Robert, is this is a great opportunity for the nationalist, third position, anti-globalist or localist or agrarian, whatever movement you're part of that's not part of the mainstream left or even the mainstream right. This is the greatest opportunity, like coronavirus was the greatest opportunity for anti-immigration people to be like, guys, immigration doesn't work. Like, it not only is it stealing our jobs and we've got 40 million unemployed and we've got 80 million foreign replacements in our country, but now it's also a biohazard. You know, that was their opportunity to really run a moratorium on immigration. And now I feel the same way about these race riots, is it's an opportunity for a moratorium on this diversity is our greatest strength, on white guilt, on black reparation, on the unhealthy culture in black neighborhoods. You know, if you look at it, it's like, there's a huge problem with black culture, but not a single black person who is influential in the mainstream media.
You do have people like black conservatives like Jesse Lee Peterson, but they're pretty...
I love that guy.
Yeah, but the thing is, he's great, but his audience is relatively small if you look at the big picture.
And it's relatively conservative. He's not taken seriously by the liberal side of the aisle. So I think what's going to come of this, Robert, I think it's a huge window into race realism for a lot of middle class people who have just gone along silently and been like, okay, I can see they don't like white people, but yeah, I'm just going to carry on with my life. Whereas now I feel like a lot of people are being forced to now decide this day who they will serve, multiculturalism or nationalism. And I, you know, a lot of people will be like, well, Scott, African Americans are American. That can be nationalism. And it's like, they're not acting American, you know? So right now, African Americans very much identify as a high in group amongst themselves. And their common unifier is victimhood and reparation from evil whiteness, you know, and no amount of pandering, to that group will absolve you of your white guilt and your white evilness. And so I don't know what the solutions are. I don't know what, you know, what's going to come next, but I feel like that's the stage that's being set up.
With the whole economic fallout, economic collapses usually do bring about like a rise in radical political ideologies. Yeah. I think you'll see it on all different angles.
Yeah, definitely. Because I think here's a big deal, you know, thrown into all of this is the fact that, you know, so many people have lost their incomes and we're such an indebted culture. You know, we're going to see people losing houses, losing cars, losing whatever consumer goods they've overspent and overbought on. And, you know, I often said when chatting with a bunch of people probably about a year back, you know, America is too comfortable to ever fight the decline. You're afraid of losing your job. You're afraid of losing your 401k. You're afraid of losing your medical insurance. You're afraid of disrupting your nice middle class life that is at any moment destroyable by political correctness. And so you're just too comfortable to become to push that bubble. Whereas now, you know, people are losing houses. They're losing livelihoods. They're losing all of that stuff. And political correctness doesn't hold any fear over you anymore because, well, I've already lost everything, so what else do I have to lose? I'm going to start talking my opinion. I'm going to start pushing back.
You were talking earlier about what you opposed about the left, whether it's Marxism, Leninism, or the more kind of mainstream left. But I think it's important to also to look at, like, conservatism in its current form. Like, what are the fundamental flaws kind of promoting, radical individualism and also
consumerism.
Yeah, consumerism and being dependent on these major corporations. And I mean, a lot of them do like discriminate against people because of their political views, but the root of it is just kind of radical individualism. So like you were mentioning like the term like third position, like what do you see like a third position would be and what is like what are the flaws of conservatism and what is needed as an alternative?
So I would describe third positionism as nationalist economics and traditional social culture. So I'm huge on the agrarian philosophies of Jefferson and obviously a modern contemporary person to really enjoy his writings is Wendell Berry. The biggest thing, I would describe my economics as agrarian versus industrialism. So the biggest problem in the West right now is industrialism, just sees people as economic units, as consuming units and producing units. And it sees, land as, just something to exploit and exhaust the resources from. Whereas agrarianism says, hey, these are my people that I love and I've grown up with, and I'm rooted into this piece of land that my people have been a part of for generations. And so what happens with the Republican elite class, the Republican political class, is that they're all big business industrialists who want just as much immigration as the left does, just for a slightly different reason. They want immigration to drive down wages for their businesses, and they want immigration to drive up property and rental prices for their rental portfolios. You know, so having 80 million foreign replacements in America is not a problem for the Republican Party.
Yeah, because so many people, especially like younger people, like the current kind of neoliberal system has economically devastated them, especially like young people who can't,
yeah,
they can't get a decent job, can't afford a place to live, or start a family. So a lot of them will turn to more left-wing socialist politics because the current neoliberal order has failed them.
Yeah, and when you say left-wing, left-wing social politics, I think that's a good way of describing it, is a lot of people don't understand the mashup that could have happened between Bernie and Trump. So Bernie is an economic leftist, all right? Well, he fails on a few things, but he wants to forgive debts to usurious bankers. He wants to destroy corporatism, big business, being involved in politics, which I thoroughly agree with. But he fails in that he's no longer against immigration. Now, if you're a good leftist politician, you know, we would say that your motivation is to help the poor and lower working class. You know, like, man, I really care about this working class. I really care about their struggles. They're all in debt. They need a higher minimum wage, all of this stuff. But if you don't deal with the problem of 80 million foreign replacements, competing with their wage and competing with their housing and competing with their benefits, like, you're not being a very good leftist. Now, on the right, with Trump, he throws out a bunch of red meat and says, let's deport the Mexicans, let's build a wall. And then, you know, everyone's like, oh my gosh, this guy loves America. He loves the American heartland. He loves us who've been forgotten. Problem is, he gets into office and it's all a show. You know, there's been no deportations. There's been no focus on America first as far as bringing back. He's had three years to bring back industry from China. He's had 3 years to make H-1B visas a lot more scarce. He's had all of these things of, like, the Republican Party is just as on the left of the Overton window as the Democrat Party is. You know, they don't care about the American worker. They don't care about the American heartland. And just like you said, what's the number one, like, what is the American dream? The American dream is have a one income household, a house in the suburbs, and a family. Like, you know, it's that simple. But that dream is dead.
What do you think about the whole idea of a kind of a, like, left-right alliance, like forming an alliance with, like, the Bernie Bros?
Yeah. So that would be the third position for me. Is, you know, it's all about negotiation. You know, that is what I do like about Trump. I read his book, The Art of the Deal, and I was like, wow, it's pretty good, pragmatic. So for me, you know, what are the two hot button issues? Okay, before all of this Corona stuff, before all of this race riot stuff, let's go back a year from today, back to 2019. What are the two hot button issues in America? It's healthcare and debt on one, healthcare and student loan debt on one side, and it's immigration and economic robustness or survival on the other hand, right? So those are your two positions that are now fighting each other. So the Republicans claim to take up the position of the economic side of, like, yep, we're going to deport. So we're going to see the economy rise. We're going to all of that kind of thing. And then on the left, you get all these people coming in saying free healthcare for everybody, forgive all student loans, higher minimum wage, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, those two things aren't mutually exclusive. We can start negotiating with each other. So for instance, when it comes to the Bernie Bros and the Trump Bros, like, I'm happy to give socialized healthcare, but to my nation. So if we went from, if we closed the borders, don't you think we'd have like a happier culture that's more homogenous? And then it's like, yeah, we can work towards healthcare for all of them. You know, that's the kind of negotiation that you can start having. You know, the next thing you can say is, student loans are hampering us. Let's make the universities eat the loans, and then at the same time, we can negotiate for something that they want, which would be this is getting really socially conservative. So this is just me having a wacky idea here, but it's like let's incentivize women having families. You know, so we'll give you student loan forgiveness, but then we want to incentivize women having families. You know, so the feminists would be like, yes, I get my dance degree for free.
Yeah, I think like someone like Tucker Carlson, he kind of flirts with those ideas, but then he reverts back to conservatism, like mainstream conservatism.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes sense, but also, like, you mentioning, like, just kind of usury, like, usury in general and banking, and that's something that appeals to, that would appeal to a lot of Bernie supporters, but I do remember, like, Occupy Wall Street, which was a left-wing movement against Wall Street, and then that kind of got, then you had the whole thing, like, kind of, like, woke, like, the whole theory about woke capital, how corporations support woke causes to kind of neutralize the economic, the class angle of the left.
Yeah. And I think that's a, you know, a great, you know, because the left is great at propaganda. They're great at shaping thought stems of how we actually think about the world. And so a great propaganda tool that I saw on Twitter from one guy, he said, basically, F Wall Street, bail out Main Street. And that is a great third position. You know, you've got all the leftist hatred towards Wall Street, but then you've got all the rightist love and patriotism of small town Americana combined to one beautiful slogan.
I initially did support Trump. I guess a lot of people were hoping for like a third position, but still, basically most of his policies have been pretty much like the conservatism that has failed.
Yeah, it's been thoroughly disappointing. I back in 2015. You know, I got on the Trump train pretty early and really enjoyed, like, I just had a thoroughly enjoyable meme war. You know, I was right there at the forefront, and I'm disappointed. I think at this point, you know, cause you also then get onto the whole thing of all the Q guys being like, oh, trust the plan.
Oh yeah.
And it's like, you know, it's not, there comes a time when pragmatism meets despair. And you know, you don't want to be in despair, so you understand why these guys gravitate to the whole QAnon conspiracy, because hey, it's getting their hopes up. But you know, when it comes, like you said, like, what chance does all these Tucker flirting with ideas, what chance do they actually have of being passed into law? And unfortunately, pragmatically, the answer is very, very slim.
Do you support UBI? Like, do you think the UBI would grant people more independence, so it would help establish more local communities, so people are less dependent upon having to move to a major center, dependent upon like these major multinational corporations?
Yeah. So again, it's a flawed answer to a huge structural flaw in our society. So, you know, here's where I'd support it. If Trump goes and says we've passed a $6 trillion stimulus package to the economy, I'd say, okay, let's divide $6 trillion by every citizen. Like, then I'm fully behind it. Like, hey, if you're going to go into debt and the money's there, let's do it. Because then it really is democratized bailouts. It's like the companies that people like are going to get bailed out by people being their customers or buying into them in shares, etc. But as far as a UBI, just, you know, as a way to buy votes, as a way to pacify people as we continue to have millions and millions of foreigners pour into the country, as we continue to have corporations rape the cities and the countrysides, to me, a UBI then becomes an opiate of the masses.
Do you see addressing ecological concerns as important? Because it's relevant to what you're talking about, industrialization, but it's something that the left has traditionally claimed a monopoly on.
Yeah, and you know, again, it comes to this whole thing of how the left has shaped narratives. They do ecology and environmentalism as a virtue signaling control scheme. So, for instance, they're big on uncontrollable policies, you know. So instead of saying what is actual ecology, it's going and what is actual environmentalism? It's going and cleaning up an actual river. It's going and planting an actual forest. It's going and making sure that small farmers have an edge, because small farms are more environmentally sustainable than huge mega industrial farms. Here's what the left instead focuses on. How can we tax people for their carbon use? How can we control, but here's what it is with the left and environmentalism. They use it as a control mechanism for Western Christian nations only. No one cares that China is pumping, you know, whatever ungodly stuff into the Yangtze River. No one cares that India is pumping whatever ungodly stuff into the Ganges River. It's only white Christian nations that are harangued and harassed and told that they're terrible and that they need to have less children. No one cares that Africa's, you know, birth rate is exploding through the sky. It's only Western white nations that the left focuses their environmentalism on.
There's that meme on Twitter, like they'll show like the UK Guardian telling people living there to reduce their birth rates, but then they'll explicitly call for massive immigration.
Exactly. And so, you know, I've again put a few tongue-in-cheek tweets together where, you know, you'll see people on Twitter saying like, oh, we could have a walkable town, which I'm all for walkable towns. We could have a walkable town of 40,000 people on this golf course. Because until you address mass immigration, you know, you're bringing basically, you know, that's what I would say about America and Europe is that you have a huge carbon footprint compared to Africa. But now you're going to import 1 million Africans a year and they're all going to drive a car. They're all going to have, you know, crazy packaging on their consumer goods and on their groceries. And the landfill is just going to be, you know, 1 million times more, the pollution, all that kind of stuff. You know, the urban sprawl that is created by importing massive amounts of people who now need cheap housing. So then you build these terrible, god-ugly urban, suburbs, and it's just not sustainable. So again, it's like saying we want free healthcare and $15 an hour, minimum wage, but then you don't do it for your people. You import a ton of other people to enjoy that. It's the same inconsistency for the left of claiming to care about the environment while supporting policies that go just the absolute opposite to what their policies would actually do.
Are you sympathetic to these different urbanist movements? There's new urbanism and kind of a movement to retrofit suburbia into more kind of walkable communities. Like you have a typical suburban street is just these, like you might have like a strip mall type store and then a big parking lot in between, and then rebuilding sort of like walkable mixed-use communities.
Big time. I thoroughly, so I was reading a book, he's probably dead now. There was an author by the name of Bill Bryson, who wrote a fantastically hilarious diary of his trip around small town America. And he coined a term that has stuck with me. It burned into me. He basically termed it modern commercial squalor, which is that duplicatable strip mall that you find outside of every little town in America. And I was like, wow, what a great word, modern commercial squalor. But basically, small town Americana has been destroyed by Walmart, by you know, all these big chain stores that come in and suck out the life of Main Street, of the mom and pop shops, the cafes, the beautiful, you know, village life. If I say to someone, think of a French village, think of a Vietnamese village, think of an African village, you get these quaint cultural traditional images coming up in your mind. If I say think of an American village, you think Walmart, you think Sonic, you think, you know, yeah. And so to answer your question, yes, I'm hugely for these urbanist, new urbanism guys. I'm hugely for the back to the land movement. I'm hugely for anything that is about beauty, about community, about rejecting globalism, rejecting modern commercial squalor, rejecting industrialism, and saying, how can we get back to life that's beautiful and not a big box strip mall of concrete? And, you know, like, so I'm fully for those guys, because even though most of them are leftists or liberals, they are practically doing a good thing when it comes to environmentalism or urbanism or communal living. And I don't say communal living as in hippies and communists. I say communal living as in knowing who your neighbor is, knowing the guy who owns the grocery store down the road, having your kids be able to go on a bike ride through the neighborhood without you knowing where they are. That kind of communal living.
Yeah, there has been this kind of a massive breakdown in social capital. Part of it is like the suburban sprawl kind of model, but a lot of it is just kind of radical individualism. People think of themselves as the individual and not part of a collective group.
Yeah, definitely. And I think a big part of that is, you know, you touch on the UBI thing of not having to move to the city. I think this lockdown might be a great thing of showing people that family is more important than, you know, a couple extra grand in the bank account, that, you know, perhaps we can find a job that's online, or, you know, one of the things I really pushed into was an economic model of the three classes of society, of, you know, your base layer being the survival economy, the middle layer being the slavery economy, and the top layer being the significance economy. What's happened in America? America is primarily a slave or a significance economy. What I mean by a slave economy is not that our bosses are all evil and stuff, but that your time is controlled by someone else, and that you're in bondage. And what are we in bondage to? We're in bondage to debt and consumerism. And what's happened is this virus has shifted the majority of America's population from the slavery economy down to the survival economy. Now, the survival economy is pretty much what we have here in Africa. It's how do I make sure I've got my safety and my security sorted out. And so the tiny house movement and the homesteading guys have been totally vindicated in this whole lockdown hysteria, because, you know, they've said, hey, I'm not going to work a corporate job in the city anymore. I'm not going to work this 40-hour week and be in debt and wage slave. You know, I'm far happier buying a tiny piece of land out in a rural town, having a small house, having a family, and, you know, basically surviving. But, you know, so I'm going to be cash poor, but I'm going to be life rich. I'm going to be culturally, communally rich.
As far as the aesthetics go of urbanism, I do think that, I mean, there is value in the left, because the left does put a stronger emphasis on that aesthetics.
Yeah.
And building, like, most of the people who are talking, there is this kind of niche of a sort of traditional urbanism. I think Wrath of Ganon, is that Twitter?
Wrath of Nyon, yeah.
Yeah, that Twitter account. But in general, I'd say it's more people on the left. But there is this kind of strain of conservatism, especially in America, where, but I think a lot of it is just kind of utilitarian. Yeah. Some conservatives are dismissive of aesthetics, because it's not just sort of a side thing. It basically influences our overall quality of life.
It influences our decisions in life. You know, Robert, no one wants to marry an ugly girl. And, you know, so when it comes to mate choice, you know, we try and marry the most beautiful girl we can get to say yes to us. And, you know, one of the things that I really find in life is that beauty elicits care. You know, my wife is beautiful and I care for her because, you know, I'm attracted to her. If my neighbors are attractive, I want to be friends with them, and I want to make sure that I keep in good standing with them. If my property is beautiful, the value increases and my value for it increases. And so what I find with aesthetics is that, you know, there's this, if you look to Genesis 1, where God puts Adam in the garden, a garden elicits a picture of beauty. Like, you know, you it's a kept place. It's beautiful. It's just a place of enjoyment, of leisure, if you want to call it. Obviously, of work, you have to work to maintain it, but the fruit is that of leisure and pleasure. And so beauty is perhaps a good word to use instead of aesthetics when talking to someone on the right, because I think they naturally understand beauty. You know, a lot of times when it comes to a property, you know, people want to live in beautiful places. I up here in Natal, I live up in the mountains, and it's beautiful. But what I find is that it's easier to neglect my property because I'm in such beautiful surroundings, I don't have to do much. Whereas in Ohio, you know, where we're looking to come back and settle near my wife's family, in Ohio it's just flat land, and I'm going to have to work a lot harder to create beauty on whatever little piece of land I
can. There's some places in the United States that you were really impressed by the beauty there.
Yeah, so you know, I traveled a bit of Northern California, and that was stunning. The you know, the forests and the volcanoes and the you know, that was really beautiful. Northern California, South Carolina. I was in Asheville. That was stunning. And even just small town South Carolina. You know, I was just blown away by it. And then in Kentucky, along the river, you know, there's these beautiful palisade gorges that the river winds through, and it's just majestic. And there's this natural beauty there. However, there's also man-made beauty. And so when I backpacked a little bit down the East Coast, and I stopped in Philadelphia, and you know, I had the most profound connection with America's history there, because it was carried through the streets, the walls, the memorials, you know, it was just this man-made beauty. Obviously not all of Philadelphia is like that. A lot of it is this decayed mess, but the places that are loved and that are maintained are, they have their own beauty that just strikes at your soul. So I think that would be my opinion on that, Robert, is that beauty invites care, and beauty invites attention. And it, you know, we want to, Wendell Berry says about land that we are the participants in a long line, a multi-generational line of caring and increasing the beauty. So he got his piece of land from his dad increased it, now it's his turn to increase the beauty, and then one day his son is going to increase the beauty. You know, what a great way to see aesthetics.
Yeah, for sure. And as far as major cities go, as there are, I mean, there are these problems as far as like the social issues or just the sort of quality of life, but from a purely aesthetic standpoint, a lot of these, I mean, major cities do still have a lot of value. As far as major cities that you visited, which ones were the most, were you the most impressed by?
Yeah, I think Philadelphia, obviously, as that was one of the first cities I, you know, had the privilege of really touring and seeing the history. So Philadelphia, definitely. I think Asheville was just stunning. And then, you know, I lived in Lexington, Kentucky for, a good 3 years. And, you know, it wasn't a beautiful city as far as like huge architecture and all of this kind of stuff. It was a beautiful city because it still retains some of that agrarian charm. It's obviously, you know, hugely based around the horse industry. But there's something like, there's something to do with coming from a disparate environment into it. So in South Africa, you know, there's nothing like that kind of Western city where civilization is different, put it that way, between Africa and America. So me coming in and experiencing Cincinnati or experiencing Lexington or experiencing, you know, Asheville or Philadelphia, those were kind of like really like mind opening to me. I was like this little kid going like, wow, this is amazing, you know. That being said, New York was way too busy and just crazy for me. And I'd say that about Cincinnati, which I'm familiar with, is that, you know, there's this beautiful downtown and this beautiful river frontage, but the modern commercial squalor, the, you know, the car centric model, the just the unsafeness of multicultural cities, like all of that kind of stuff degrades what could be the beauty of many cities.
Back to the economic angle, there is this kind of issue of a radical individualism in this country, and I think in the future, economic survival will increasingly depend upon being part of some kind of a group that will look out for you, and basically you find your job through your in-group.
Yeah, I think individualism is a, you know, it's number one. It's the individualism is only possible in a highly civilized society. So if you are in, you know, let's take Africa, for instance, right? So if I don't have an in-group, you know, it's life is tribal here. You know, you can't trust the police. You can't hope that they are going to protect you. You can't really trust the court system. And so individualism doesn't get you very far when your survival counts on a tribe liking you, on a tribe finding you valuable. And so in America, you know, the decay isn't as bad. It's heading that way. But basically people have been able to basically say, screw you, I don't have to be a good person, I don't have to be a valuable person, I've got my money, and screw all of you guys, I don't care about your social customs, your norms, what would, you know, serve the group. And if I end up failing, well, then I just move to the next place and start over. And so I think that's the type of individualism that's going to start catching up with people, where, you know, we are going to see communities and towns adopting this kind of, you know, I would say that about post-Christian American society, is that people are too nice to shun. Well, I mean, not anymore with political correctness. People are more than happy to shun people with politically incorrect opinions. But people are going to start shunning people who don't add to the community, who aren't valuable people, who aren't fit to serve the community's interests going forward in the long term. And I think the way you'll see that is you know, the way that property is sold and the way that businesses are done, you know, services and products are provided. I think you're going to see this discrimination, which is a good thing. And I love the word discrimination. It's not the bad propaganda word. I think you've got to discriminate between people who are good for your tribe and people who are bad. And, you know, a lot of people have issue with the Indians and the Jews and the Greeks, but those three cultural groups have such a high in-group preference when it comes to community and business. They really look out for each other. They really dominate their own institutions that are good for their own tribe. And I think American, you know, your heritage American, if you want to call it that, can learn a lot from those three groups.
Yeah, the whole concept of nepotism versus a meritocracy. And yeah, meritocracy is sort of based on radical individualism. But the thing is, if one group is more nepotistic, then you mean you can't really like complain about, you can't really complain about them, but you have to sort of, it's better to kind of learn from those groups.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Complaining is going to do nothing. It's what am I doing about my own life? You know, complaining is political, organizing is practical. And I think, you know, we've been a very political culture for so long. I talk generally as an Anglo. I think the Anglosphere, we've been a very political culture for so long that groups who are more pragmatic have come in and really capitalized at our expense. And we have to reciprocate and do that ourselves.
Scott, we're getting close to the end of the show, but do you want to plug your website and your YouTube channel?
Yeah, thanks, man. So my website is scotttungay.com. That's my blog. I chat a lot about wealth, land, and power. So obviously my focus is on cultural dominance of the Anglosphere man. You know, so my Twitter is at Courage My Lads, or just Scott Tungay. You'll find me on Twitter. That's where I'm most active. And then my YouTube channel is Scott and Kelly. So with my wife, we speak into cultural dominance. You know, we like to really just touch on traditional marriage, traditional family. We talk a bit about land and you know, our attempts at homesteading. So yeah, that's where you guys can find me at.
Scott Tungay, it has been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you, Robert. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, man. Thank you.